Okay. I call this meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy to order. And before we get started, I'm not Bill Morissette, although we do look an awful lot alike. Bill is back home. His wife, Janice, has had some, what we hope is minor medical issues, and she has been in the hospital for a couple of days. According to Don, she's going to be released today, and Bill is absolutely where he needs to be. So he is home with his wife taking care of her. And so Janice will be in all of our prayers. With that, I will open an organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29, 2009.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29, 2009. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the rules are adopted. Do any of the members wish to say anything for the good of the order before we start?
It's good to be back and good to see you as chair, and sorry that Bill couldn't be with us today, and we do wish Jenny well.
Yes.
Just no monkey business.
No monkey business?
I was admonished not to go crazy with the gavel, and I pointed out that it's an interim committee with informational hearings, so I'm not sure how much crazy I could go. So, well, yeah, there is that. Okay. With that, I'll close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting. Update on long-term care and assisted living facilities, James and Arthur. That's a good point.
Just totally disoriented.
We're in a backwards committee room. Okay, that's fine. However you want to proceed. James, you going first?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, Senior and People with Disabilities Division. We were asked to give an update on where we're at with long-term care, based on the many issues that you're all very much aware of over the past 3 or 4 years. And just to recap, during the 2005-2007 session, a lot of concerns were raised about the infrastructure in long-term care, about the rapidly declining Medicaid capacity in assisted living, foster care, and residential care facilities, because the private pay rates had so far outstripped the state's Medicaid rates, and so we had a serious concern about declining capacity. We had a spike in nursing home placements for the first time in 20 years. For 20 years, the nursing home utilization rate had declined at a steady clip over that entire period of time, and suddenly with a decline in community capacity, we had an increase in nursing facility caseloads. And then during the interim committee, of which some of you were part, we did a lot of work in the interim between the 07 and 09 sessions and out of the special session in 2008. This committee, along with House Interim Committee, introduced Senate Bill 1061, which really gave some pretty explicit directions to the department to develop a long-range plan, which we presented during this last regular session. The other key thing that the interim committee during that time did, and that led up to the supplemental session in 2008, was work at an interim rate increase to try to at least initially close the gap between Medicaid rates and private pay rates to try to stabilize our long-term care system. And some of you worked very, very hard on that issue, and we did then do a $260 across-the-board rate increase for foster care, assisted living, and residential care facilities to help stabilize that rate. We then, during the regular session, presented the rest of the long-range plan that mostly got lost in the budget crisis, understandably so. We had worked with all the stakeholder groups to propose about a $140 million package, which seemed like a lot, but as we pointed out of a $3.5 billion budget, it really wasn't a massive amount of investments to try to stabilize some of the existing services, continue to improve the rates, make some critical changes in adding mental health care for seniors and others. And we're going to, I think, in the next panel, really deal with the pre-Medicaid part of the plan, and that is how do we reach out to the public at large, seniors, to try to keep them at home, healthy, safe, before they spend down, before they will ever need long-term care, with lots of information, counseling, respite care for caregivers, healthy living, other kinds of strategies, financial counseling, and we're going to get into that because in the meantime we've secured a whole series of federal grants to help us move in that direction, and we'll deal with that in the next panel. I wanted to briefly walk you through some of the numbers that were such a concern, and you have a handout with two charts on it. The first chart looks like this. It's simply a summary of our caseload forecast. And the important thing, if you look in the far left-hand column in both the in-home categories and community-based care, you can see in the in-home program the actuals averages through July 05 through 07. A little over 11,000 for the in-home program, and for the rest of community-based care, which is 24-hour care and assisted living, foster care, other areas, it was a little over 10,000. And when you look at now the averages we have, and I'll point out for in a minute why we only have through March of this last year, and the first column, if you look at the third column from the left, it says average actual November 08 through March of 09. You can see the home care numbers are about 10,612. Then below the subtotal for community-based care, a little over 11,000. So those caseloads have stabilized, and actually during the 05-07 biennium, they were continuing to decline. They've stabilized, and we've actually revised from fall of 08 to spring of 09 our forecast up in those two categories. And that's actually the first time in about 4 years that these caseloads are actually starting to go up. Then if you look at the very bottom in our caseload forecast for nursing facilities, you can see the actuals July 05 through 07 as a monthly average were a little over 5,000. Originally, when we put the budget together for the 05-07 biennium, the nursing home count was expected, the Medicaid portion of the nursing home count was expected to decline to about 4,600. So that was the concern during that period, that the nursing facility counts were actually increasing as community caseloads were going down. Where we're at right now is a bit troubling. We're still working through, and I'm sure you've heard, a lot of the issues that have been raised with MMIS, because all of our payment systems now for community-based care, residential facilities, all have to roll up and go through the MMIS system that we use then to generate the numbers for caseload counts. And those counts are still, we're troubleshooting those all the time. They're just not accurate enough numbers, and we're having to go back, and it's a long, complicated story, back into our subsystems to try to pull that information out. And we're hoping within a matter of a month or two that we will have new revised numbers, whether it's from MMIS or our other subsystems, to really peg where we're at right now. But we believe we're still growing the community caseload, and the nursing home facility counts are still coming down. We'll confirm that in a revised caseload count and then a reprojected caseload forecast. But the good news is that we're back on the trends that we were before sort of the crisis hit in 05-07. How that translates into Medicaid capacity is on the second chart, which is a little easier to read. House Bill 3626, also from the supplemental session, did several things. In addition to the rate increase across the board, as you will recall, we ended the moratorium on construction of new residential care facilities and assisted living, ended that moratorium. And the legislature also directed us to make a periodic report back on whether the combination of the end of the moratorium and the interim rate increase had actually contributed to a stabilization of the Medicaid program. And the good news is that it has. If you look at the numbers across the board, licensed facilities, the italicized number is January of 08. The darker number is June of 09. So you can see in a couple critical categories, assisted living, not so much in foster care. I'll get back to that. On the commercial side, relative foster care, we saw modest increases in the number of licensed providers. When you look at the numbers of facilities in Medicaid, because again, we license facilities that serve people both spending down or on private pay as well as on Medicaid. The facilities in Medicaid, there's actually again a slight increase in residential care facilities, assisted living, slight increase, commercial foster care and relative foster care as well. Then when you actually look at the third column down, the actual number of Medicaid clients, which is the real important figure, you can see in each of those categories that those numbers have trended up. Not substantially, but nonetheless a very, very good trend compared to where we were at as briefly as a year, year and a half ago. And then the other thing that we track is gradual withdrawal contracts in which programs or companies tell us they're going to withdraw from the Medicaid program, convert to private pay. And again, we have, particularly in RCFs and assisted living, many less Medicaid withdrawal contracts than we had for that period going back to 2007, 2008.
Yeah, Senator Sanderson.
I'm not quite sure. What does the 2/3 actually mean then? And the 10/5 at the bottom for withdrawal.
I'm sorry. Again, if you look at the italicized number, means the number of residential care facilities in January of 2008 that we had with Medicaid withdrawal contracts, meaning they were getting out of the Medicaid program. And for June of this last year, it's 3. But then when you look at RCF's assisted living, the number in withdrawal are actually much less. So that's an overall program that's telling us we are ending our Medicaid contract. And typically what happens in a withdrawal is an organization will say, we don't want to renew our Medicaid contracts, but we will continue to serve the people that are here now with the Medicaid program, but we will not admit any new individuals that are Medicaid eligible. And that's usually companies and organizations work with us cooperatively in that way, so we don't displace a whole bunch of individuals. We had that serious case on the coast a couple years ago where an organization out of state just literally threw all the Medicaid residents out in one fell shot. It was very disruptive and very hard on the residents and the families. But typically a withdrawal contract means that we over time withdraw. But again, the good news is many less organizations now are contemplating withdrawing from the Medicaid contract. I think the other important telling point is I don't think it's just because of the good work that the legislature and the department might have done in terms of the rate structure, but I think the economy also contributes to this. People can't sell their houses, and so elderly folks who otherwise might decide to sell their house and move into assisted living, I think now the private pay market is a bit stifled as well in these uncertain economic times. So I think that contributes to the ironic stability of the Medicaid program for this period. We're still deeply concerned about the future. When we made the commitment in February of 08 to increase those rates, we considered that to be an interim rate change. We then were charged by the legislature to develop a whole new rate schedule that would become much more competitive with private pay. We did. That was, again, sort of lost in the budget crisis of the last session, but it's still something that we intend to come back again and again and again, because if we simply hold our place in line where we're at right now and the private pay rates start going back up again, we'll be in the same crisis in the next couple of years that we were a couple of years ago. So it still remains an issue that we have to attend to, and that's part of the reason that I think you all told us to keep tracking these numbers very closely and why we think it's very important to keep looking at the capacity. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What about those facilities that do not take Medicaid clients, but then some of their clients spin down? Are they required to maintain them once they hit Medicaid eligibility?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monis Anderson, technically no, although often in the Medicaid withdrawal contracts, they will agree that anybody that's currently there that spends down can stay there. So, but that would not apply to new admissions. Technically they could spend down and say, we don't have a Medicaid contract, we're not going to serve you anymore. Generally that hasn't happened. I think in most cases organizations and companies have worked with us. And in some cases when we've had to relocate people, we've had ample time to do that. We were asked several times by different legislators, could we in fact legally require that? We don't think, we consulted with the Department of Justice, and we don't think we can legally require someone to absolutely accept Medicaid, but our hope still is that we can continue to work with the industry and in a way that mitigates that.
Any other questions? Thank you, James. Arthur.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. I'm going to spend a couple minutes celebrating victories that you've achieved here over the course of the past year. I think that during this economic crisis, that it's easy to lose track that you've actually made a lot of progress in a couple key areas. James kind of stole my thunder on one of them, and that is that there's actually been an 8% increase in the number of adult foster homes that are taking Medicaid clients since you raised the rates in February 2008. And that's a big deal, because we vulnerable Oregonians need a place to stay. Big problem, obviously, in Lincoln County. You got the job done, and you ought to be proud of your accomplishments there. Also, because of your willingness to raise funds in order to draw down the federal matching funds, we've been able to make progress in skilled nursing facilities as well. Over the course of the past couple of years, Oregon's moved from number 30 in the country to number 6 in terms of safe nursing home staffing. And that's another big accomplishment. Our members out on the front lines talk about call lights that can be answered now. They talk about, being able to avoid problems like bed sores that are easily dealt with when you have enough people to do the work. And really the other piece is the human touch, where care providers can actually spend time with lonely and vulnerable Oregonians and, spend time treating them like people rather than, making it some big cattle call, rushing them through bathing and feeding and everything else. And that got done because y'all were willing to make those sorts of changes. And one thing I really worry about in your line of work is that you don't see the human impact as much as you should. And our members see that and are deeply appreciative of the work that you've done. So be clear that you've made some good progress in the face of a few daunting challenges here. Okay, that's enough celebration. So let's move forward to the problems. One area that we're concerned about is we still have some work to be done in terms of improving training in adult foster care, and we're plugging away on that. We're in bargaining with adult foster care providers in the state, and over the course of time, we want to make some progress there. We also want to continue to retain home care workers because it feels very clear that the quality of care improves if you don't have McDonald's scale of turnover in that field. And the progress that we've made there has been in large part to increasing the wages a little bit and then providing health care for those individual workers. And so that tends to attract people who want to stick around and do the work. But we're now at the point where we have 40% of home care workers who don't receive the number of hours they need to qualify for home care. And so that's something else that we're keeping our eye on. In terms of policy issues as opposed to budgetary issues, my sense is that workforce development is really the next thing just over the horizon. And with healthcare reform looming nationally, there's almost certainly going to be a shortage of trained workers. And you know, many policymakers focused on the nursing shortage, but this committee over the course of time has really demonstrated its awareness that allied healthcare fields are an equal cause of concern, that problems with shortages of certified nurse aides, home care workers, adult foster care providers, and kind of the whole laundry list of caregivers could be a real problem, especially in rural Oregon, where you have 5 to 6% of the workforce employed in this field. So there are solutions to this challenge. Job training is one obvious approach, and so that's one piece of the puzzle. But the second area revolves around making the workforce a little bit more flexible. We need to figure out a way to make it easier for trained and qualified care providers to stay in long-term care but move from one care setting to the other more readily. And we've bumped up against this problem in a couple different areas. One area is it's challenging if you're a certified nurse aide and you leave, say, a nursing home to go provide home care to keep your CNA certification. And so that's something that we're looking at possibly addressing in the 2011 session to make it a little bit easier for people who are doing similar work to not have quite the big barrier to go back and start over to get their CNA certification if they are, again, doing similar type of work. The second area we've come across in talking to some employers in the care providing field is the challenge with workers who are employed in, say, one care facility. Become an employee, you have to pass a criminal background check, and that's a good thing. That's something we ought to be doing. But if I'm working, say, I get 30 hours a week at one nursing facility, and then I want to pick up another shift at another facility, then the employer has to go out and spend, you know, whatever it is, $100, a couple hundred bucks, to do another criminal background check on me again. And what we want to do is maybe examine if there's a way to, while preserving the integrity of the system, preserving the quality of care, streamline that process a little bit and make it easier for people to move from one area to another, because all these folks are going through background checks, you know, child care providers, group home workers, nursing homes, assisted living, whatever the case might be. Is there a way to streamline that and move it forward? And we're looking at kind of what are the possibilities there. Well, again, you know, emphasizing we really want to make sure people do pass the criminal background checks and the care is safe and unethical and unprofessional people aren't, you know, getting forward. So heads up.
Arthur, you're looking kind of like a TCSP thing, the way teachers do it now. I mean, there's a central clearinghouse.
Maybe. I didn't exactly want to raise that example because they've had a few problems.
Well, yeah, but it's a central clearinghouse, and so if you've had a background check, the first and you go to get another job, the first thing that employer could do is check with the crane house to see if you've had a background check.
Another idea, Mr. Chair, have you talked with the Board of Nursing? Because CNAs are under the Board of Nursing, correct?
Right.
And is there a way to have the clearinghouse actually connected with their license?
Chair Cruz, Senator Miles Anderson, we've started digging into this and talked to the gentleman at the Department of Human Services who oversees criminal background checks, and my understanding is that there's several dozen different occupations or care settings where you need a criminal background check. Each one of those has slightly different tweaks involved in it, and so it's a there's a lot of this work that's going on in the department. I think the Board of Nursing might be one setting, but there's a lot of workers who are not under the Board of Nursing purview who this would affect. And so there's a lot of different ways to go about it, but it could be a way to streamline some operations, could be a way to look at this a little bit differently and just improve the whole process for private sector employers and in terms of government efficiency, too.
So, and you're saying it's $100, so it's obviously an FBI background check, not a LEDS, correct?
I wouldn't swear to exactly what the dollar figure is, but my understanding is something in that area.
Well, that would indicate to me that it's FBI, so just that dollar figure, which is interesting. Why it wouldn't be this LEDS, but that's a whole other issue.
Mr. Chairman, there's different levels. If you lived outside of the state within the past 5 years. It's an automatic FBI check. Then there's other questions on the LEDs that can trigger. So it's not an across-the-board FBI check. In many cases, it is just LEDs. But Art is absolutely right. What's happened is, I mean, it's such a complex area, and we've had, over time, different crimes that qualify or disqualify a person, so you have different criteria for different kind of care settings. The lawyers always tell us you really have to do a weighing test. I mean, you're playing with a person's employment rights, so you have to look at the crime, the actual type of care that the person will provide. So getting to a uniform set of criteria and then a uniform database. And, of course, over time, we also want to add abuse data because a person can have some very serious abuse events that they've committed, but it's never been substantiated as a criminal conviction. But, again, pulling all those different data systems together and having then identical criteria that can translate and a person can literally carry that from one setting to another, there's a lot of work going on in that. I can't answer the detailed questions of when we think that might actually come together, but it's certainly our goal.
Well, I would hope so. I'm sure what we've done is we've decided to do background checks on this group, and we've set up rules, and then we decided to do background checks on that group and set up rules, and so we've created all separate universes, and probably something that should have, I don't see any reason why you couldn't have uniformity in it, so that would be helpful. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, again, thank you, Chair. And it does feel like it's something that might be worth, you know, digging into a little bit, seeing what the possibilities are, because it could make life a lot easier on a lot of fronts. And the other element to this, in my opinion, is that it could. One thing that we're very anxious about is the idea of career ladders for these workers. And so making it easier for people to move from one care setting to another, we think could also help them advance their careers in this field, too. So that's another element that we're talking about, because, again, you're talking about low-wage women workers, as you all know, and figuring out ways for people to advance. And if they have it in their hearts to do this work, being able to economically stay in the field is really a good thing, and because it's horrible, the idea that we have to lose people who want to care for others because they can't feed their families. And so that's, you know, what we're aiming for. You know, I spend a lot of my time here before your committee talking about workforce issues, and, you know, that obviously is the, you know, we're a union, for God's sake, but we are interested in, you know, obviously quality issues, and we're interested in, you know, broader issues in long-term care. We know that there's need to enhance special needs transportation, mental health services for seniors, the pre-Medicaid work that Mr. Taves referred to is important. Our members provide both care for both the Medicaid population, and some provide non-Medicaid care. So we get that's important too. It's not an either-or sort of situation. So, you know, quality is critical to us. The workforce issues are closely related, but to be strong advocates for long-term care, we know that these other pieces are important as well. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer more questions if that'd be helpful.
Questions? Senator Ledger.
How do you feel that you're doing with projections? In other words, as far as projecting caseloads and so forth, are you pretty much on target? It's a little early after the budget session, but I'd be kind of curious.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think our caseload counts are going to be okay. We've worried, and as you know from the last session, with all of our caseloads, if you look at TANF and food stamps, I mean, we have certain caseloads that have simply been in the stratosphere. But on the long-term care side, we had relative stability, which was good in this particular budget climate. But again, we're projecting an increase. We think that increase will grow over time. We think it'll still be within budget. Extracting the data because of some of the MMIS glitches right now is troubling, because you want to be right on top of those numbers every month. But I think for now, we think our caseload counts are fairly stable, and the projection is going to hold. That's not true in the coming years. Well, I shouldn't say the projections won't be true, but the numbers are going to start climbing very, very rapidly within the next 4 to 6 years, because we're ironically in this little trough. If you look at the aging demographic right now, the older of the old are growing at a fast clip, but the way that trough works, that really takes off in. So I think in future biennium, perhaps even the next one, we'll see significant expansion of that caseload. But at this point, it's pretty stable, growing slightly, and I think it'll hold for this biennium, hopefully.
The baby boomers are age, the beginning of the baby boomers are age 62, 63 right now, so I would think that 10 to 15 years ago, from now, is when they will be hitting the long-term care era for them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, yeah, and if you recall, we could pull those spreadsheets out again, and we actually did detailed numbers over a 20-year period, so you could see each of those age cohorts and how they grow. And obviously the biggest growth now is just the people turning 65, but they're not the most likely candidates to need long-term care. It's the 85-plus, which is also a group that's going to more than double within the next 20 years as well. And the troubling thing always about those numbers is, and we talked a lot during the long-range plan, because when you go beyond Oregon and you look nationally, the previous comptroller general, and long before the health care debate started, said, if you just look at Medicaid and Medicare, just leave out Social Security for a minute, just look at Medicaid and Medicare and load the aging demographic on that, by about 2045, almost the entire federal budget is just Medicaid and Medicare, nothing else. So it's all very clear that something has to give, and that will hit us all. So
hopefully, Mr. Chair, the baby boomers are really healthy.
I'm not going to get old myself.
And we're, yeah, not going to get old.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I've
got one more panelist on this panel, Ruth Goyas. I'm sorry I didn't bring you up earlier, but this way you get the whole stage all to yourself. So.
Senator Cruz, members of the committee, I am Ruth Gullius. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, representing not-for-profit mission providers of long-term care. And our members include the full continuum of service providers, so it's assisted living, residential care, nursing, retirement communities, and we have a large portion of low-income housing providers subsidized through the federal government. In order to paint a picture for you of where the field is at, certainly from our perspective, I did a quick little survey of my members. I sent six questions out to them on Friday and received a lot of responses back, and I just will share with you what exactly where they're at this moment in time and what some of the trends are. The questions that I asked were, what have you experienced in the last 6 months, both in your Medicaid occupancy, private pay occupancy? What do you attribute the change to, if you've seen one, and obviously many have? How's the economy impacted residents and hence you? And then, importantly, speaking to the aging, the baby boomers and where we need to be at in 20 years, there needs to be significant innovation taking place right now. And with the economy, what has that done to the innovation that normally takes place in the field? And then lastly, and importantly, is there anything else that they would like you all know to know? So, and the first question in terms of occupancy, what I've heard back from members substantiates what James' numbers gave you. There are some differences, and it probably it has to do with who they're targeting and maybe what area of the state that they're in. But on the assisted living side, there's definitely been an increase, several members said, in their Medicaid census, a lot fewer private pay people knocking on their doors. And a part of that is a result of not being able to serve their homes, though assisted living is much more need-driven. But people are also making a decision to hang out at home a little longer, making ends meet. So what I had one member tell me is that folks, the private pay folks that do come in through the door, have more related health care needs than perhaps that they did before we had the economic situation hit. Others, they've had their occupancy rates have been stable. Others up and down. With our low-income housing, of course, because it's need-based, that continues to be waiting list on to federally subsidized housing. Multi-level campuses, again, because it's need-driven, you'll have your nursing home and assisted living had maintained stability for the most part on the independent living side, again, because of losing assets in retirement and selling houses. That's delayed entrance into moving into independent living. All have said, no surprise here, that if you've experienced a change, what do you attribute it to? The economy. One member did say they felt that part of their reason was for a decline in hospital occupancies, which was intriguing to me. Declines in referrals for dementia care, and some are seeing a result of, I think, some of the state's diversion efforts in terms of how that has impacted nursing facility occupancy rates. What changes are they making? Well, given all this, many of them are looking inward at operations. A lot are spending more on marketing, doing more with less, just really critiquing where they're at in operations and maintaining quality care at the same time, doing partnership with others. The change in the economy on residents, no surprise here again. Residents are very nervous. They look at what the resources were when they have moved in, how that's changed over the last 6 months, and will they be able to maintain paying for the care that they're receiving. Some have experienced are asking providers to move into less expensive units, maybe downsizing the type of unit that they're in, and also inquiring about some of the resident assistance programs within the mission-directed providers. We've got members who perhaps don't take Medicaid. They keep them off of Medicaid. If somebody runs out of money, they have an assistance program. Those funds, there's been increased inquiries for those sorts of programs. I've had one member where their resident assistance program request for that has gone up 19%. In relation to innovation, I guess no surprise here, because of what's happening at a time when we should be planning and innovating, some of that's still going on, but the development plans are obviously have been put on hold, and some have deferred some maintenance, and that obviously can't continue to be they're hoping not to be a long run impact. What else would they like you to know? We thank you for the bump in rates this last time around. That has made a difference. It's made a difference in many members being able to continue serving the Medicaid population and the increase. One last one, in a difficult part of the state, a comment was help. I would like to share some of the good news about the quality initiatives underway. There's several quality initiatives, and Oregon's been a very creative, innovative state. And we've been the lucky recipients, much because of our track record in working collaboratively together. We've received some very competitive federal grants to work on workforce issues. Most recent one coming to completion was called Jobs to Careers, and it used a jobs-based training curriculum where they do on-the-job training, train mentors, and create some career tracks for the direct care workers within assisted living. And for the first time, that does a lot to professionalize the profession. Direct care workers that completed the curriculum in this program are eligible for college credits at Portland Community College. So that was really a big accomplishment of the grant. And we have been talking with the state on how do we further disperse the good work that's come out of the quality initiative so that more people can take part in some of the tools that have been developed. Very quickly, two other programs that have come to completion this year that we hope to disseminate more widely. There was a joint project between the nursing home, National Nursing Home Initiative and Hospital Initiative to work on transitional care between nursing homes and hospitals on the whole issue of pressure ulcers. An outcome of that project is a toolkit and a handoff data set that then can be used by other communities that perhaps want to work on their pressure ulcer incidence of pressure ulcers internally, but also that want to do a collaborative effort on a regional basis. Another program that we're very proud of and excited and hope can be replicated in other parts of the state. I have left a handout here that goes into a little more detail on that, and with that, I will just bring it to a close and any questions that you might have.
Questions?
Just a brief comment. Does the Alliance ever look at reasons for dementia, reasons for Alzheimer's? Do you get into that, or are you just strictly dealing with what do you deal with? I mean, other than tracking
we,
what you
as a trade association, membership mm-hmm. association, we provide training and education around the topics for our members. There's good research being done through Oregon Health Sciences University on dementia care and some developmental work with technology around that. But as an organization, we try to facilitate the research and the sharing of the information rather than do it ourselves.
Yeah. Just follow up. I forget where I read this, but they're now looking at pesticides and the use of pesticides and their effect on aggravating in certain individuals, because not all of us react to drugs the same way or the pesticides, toxic chemicals, that there may be a correlation to dementia, Alzheimer's with pesticides. And I was just wondering if you look at that. And they're even correlating that to other autoimmune diseases, et cetera, in our youth. So, but you don't really deal with that.
Chair Cruz and Senator Montes Anderson, we definitely try to get the most state-of-the-art information out to the field to make sure that they are aware of that. And I think the good news and all the research that's going on is we keep learning.
Yeah, I think I heard that the blue dye used in M&Ms right
and yellow
might have a positive impact on dementia. But, so I'm eating a lot of M&Ms now, just the blue ones. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will go into an update on SPD long-range planning and grants. James, back up, along with Lane Young and Karen. Okay. You're also up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disabilities Division. We were asked to give an update on where we're at with our long-range planning efforts, including some recent federal grants and breakthroughs that we've had on that. One of the biggest efforts in our planning for the future is not simply how to fix, stabilize, and expand the Medicaid system, but as you've probably heard from us many times before, our biggest interest is to keep particularly seniors and other people with disabilities at home, safe, independent, not needing paid public assistance for as long as possible. And I think clearly that's one of the biggest strategies in dealing with the entire aging demographic. We're working along with many other states, and there's a growing federal agenda now, to put together networks in every single state of what are called ADRCs, Aging and Disability Resource Centers, which are not providers in the traditional sense. We don't provide long-term care. We don't provide Medicaid services. But under this whole umbrella, it has multiple components, but it really includes aggressive information and counseling and assistance, to people before they spend down the Medicaid. Other kinds of supports like OPI, where a state can provide a limited in-home benefit that can really keep a person at home and independent for a much longer period of time. Supporting caregivers, most of the care in this country provided to seniors is provided by relatives and other caregivers who can easily burn out without support. Healthy aging, falls prevention, those are many of the things that, if implemented, taken to scale across our communities, can really provide long-term support before, again, people need full paid public assistance. There is legislation pending in Congress that I think has some pretty broad support. It's now actually one of the 500 amendments to the Senate Health Reform Bill, but it was also an independent bill before that time that would provide additional funding across the country to put this network of aging and disability resources together and to actually provide federal match. And it may be, as we're doing some of the research, be one of the areas where we can finally use our Oregon Project Independence Fund to draw down federal match for some of those activities again. And we've actually now seen a variety of private consultants, but the Congressional Budget Office is also beginning to score some of these proposals, and it's actually said if you really implement these approaches nationwide, you can reduce the costs of Medicaid and Medicare substantially over time, or at least tilt down that demand line. So that is a huge part of our effort, and both Elaine and Kay, I want to talk about some of the really exciting proposals that we're working on right now, which are part of this bigger network of resources that we hope to have in place within a matter of years. So,
I'm Elaine Young, I'm Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities, and thank you for letting us share some good news that we've heard about this week. But going back a year, we received a $1.6 million three-year grant from Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. We partnered with Lane County Council of Governments and Sacred Heart Hospital. The grant was a two-part grant. One, the development of a person-centered discharge planning model with the hospital. And the second part of the grant was the development, as James just talked about, of an aging and disability resource center in Lane County. And then there's a connection between the two in terms of care transitions. On the hospital side, developing a high-risk screening tool to identify patients early in their hospital admission that they may be at risk for institutionalization or readmission to the hospital because of their chronic care conditions, and then to intervene with them early, and to also do post-hospital follow-up telephone calls with them to assure that the plan from the hospital is effectively working with them. If it is not based on that hospital follow-up phone call, they would then connect with Lane Council of Governments and the Aging and Disability Resource Center to connect with what we're calling a community health navigator. They can go out to that person's home and shore up those community supports so that they don't go back into the hospital or into a nursing facility. We are 1 year into the planning of that three-year grant. We are pilot testing the high-risk screening tool and the telephone follow-up script with the hospital as we speak. And then I'm going to turn it over to Kay to talk about her work with her staff on the development of the Aging and Disability Resource Center.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Kay Metzger. I'm the Director of Senior and Disabled Services, which is a division of Lane Council of Governments, and we're the Area Agency on Aging in Lane County. And yes, we have been working in partnership with Elaine Young and the State of Oregon on the person-centered discharge planning, working with Sacred Heart and collaborating in their planning efforts. In addition to that, we've also been working on planning and implementing a local Aging and Disability Resource Center and what that is going to look like within a local community. So you've got a handout there. There's two layers to it. One is kind of looking externally. First, we spent a lot of time listening and learning. We've taken part in several teleconferences and phone calls with current ADRCs in other states and learning from them. Teleconferences telling us, sharing some study results about good customer service and what people want to see and hear when they come to an aging and disability resource center. And then we've also done a lot of one-to-one contact within the Lane County community, our local partners in human services. So just today I met with United Way and talked to them. They operate our 211 system. Talked to them about how we can work together. I've met with Lane County organization and the Human Services Commission on how we can work with them and informing them of the grant and what we're moving towards. Met with Lane Independent Living Alliance, who focuses on working with people with physical disabilities in a peer mentorship role and how we can work with them and what they want to see, what people using their services want to see when they come to an aging and disability resource center. And there's a whole list of folks that we've already talked to. Just asking for input on what do you want to see when we roll out and learning at the planning level so that we can implement those practices that people really want to see. In addition to that, the state has also contracted with the University of Oregon's Community Planning Workshop. It's a part of the master's program in planning work over at the U of O. And they will be doing some interviews and some focus groups and actually put out a survey, an online survey using SurveyMonkey that will go out to folks so that people can respond and let us know what they want to see in an aging and disability resource center. So we spent a lot of time looking externally to say, you know, what do folks want to see in an aging and disability resource center? And then secondly, we've invested staff time to look internally, to look at our current processes, and to begin to try to think differently about how we offer services. We operate the Medicaid and food stamp program. There's a lot of hoops to jump through, as I'm sure you know, but many times our staff are very program-driven. When they talk to somebody, they try to think about which program they can fit them into. And what we're trying to do is train staff to think of people in more of a person-centered mode, where you're looking at the person rather than just trying to fit them into a program. So we're constantly training staff on that. Our support staff are going through a training program on information and assistance through an AIRS program. It's called Alliance of Information and Referral Systems. It's a big manual. So we're working with them weekly to train them on that. We spent time talking about what options counseling is and created some protocols. So we've done a lot of internal work also, and we're continuing to move forward on looking at our agency and how we can do a better job, really, of doing information and assistance and implement this grant. So we're pretty excited about it, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Questions? I think you will, in about 15 months, as I understand, you'll have a new tremendous ally on the Lane County Board of Commissioners, but that's speculation at this point.
That's
okay. Mr. Chairman? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment. I have Western Lane in my district. I just want to compliment Kay Metzger. They do a fabulous job keeping me informed and in their activities, and you're very, very hardworking, very organized, and enthusiastic. And so I appreciate you very much, even though you're not seeing my face right there. I'm very aware, and I read the material that you send, and good job.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
Senator Cruz, members of the committee, I want to share we have been awarded 4 additional grants building on the grant that we just told you about. We received a second Aging and Disability Resource Center grant from the Administration on Aging to expand the work that we've started in Lane County to Lynn Benton, Lincoln counties, and Marion Polk, Yamhill. Clatsop and Tillamook counties. So the total, the mid-Willamette Valley area of the state, which actually represent about 30% of older adults in the state, will be benefited by looking at our current systems and enhancing those to better serve folks with good information so that they can make informed decisions about the care and supports they need as they grow older or to deal with their chronic health conditions. Additionally, we received an additional year of funding on a three-year grant that we had. It's an additional $200,000 to support physical activity programs for older adults, Tai Chi, which is evidence-based in terms of preventing falls, and the support of a peer-led six-week course on chronic disease self-management. Again, that's in about four regions of our state, particularly with that grant, but with a statewide perspective. And I want to say all of these initiatives have a statewide perspective to them. Additionally, we just learned that we received, again from the Administration on Aging, a two-year grant, a community living program grant, which was formerly a grant program called Nursing Home Diversion that Multnomah County and Washington County will be utilizing to bring in some aspects of an aging and disability resource center to better serve folks that are at high risk of institutionalization or hospital readmission, and a whole array of activities to realign and enhance their existing systems to better serve folks. And then lastly, we also got news that we received an Administration on Aging grant for an Alzheimer's demonstration grant. This will be taking a research-based program out of the University of Washington and implementing that in Multnomah County and in Jackson and Josephine counties, utilizing existing case managers to support family caregivers who are providing care to persons with Alzheimer's disease, specifically to help them understand the disease process, to help them with communication, to mitigate behavioral problems associated with the disease process. And the research has shown really significant improvements in the burnout level of caregivers and in the quality of life of folks that are dealing with that disease. So just to do a quick rundown of dollars, federal dollars coming into our state. Again, the Lane County grant was $1.6 million over 3 years. The new ADRC grant is $738,000 over 3 years. We got an additional $200,000 for the evidence-based physical activity and chronic disease management program, $700,000 over 2 years for the nursing home diversion program that Washington and Multnomah counties will be implementing, and $881,000 over 3 years for the Alzheimer's demonstration grant.
Question. What percentage of your budget comes from federal grants?
Mr. Chairman,
because everyone says we're
it's again the overall budget of the Senior and Disabilities Division is $3.3 billion. It's maybe between three and four million total, so relatively
million.
Small percentage.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Burns, you're up.
Huh?
I'll be good.
Okay.
And Missy, I was told you were going to stay in the back, but Tom wouldn't let you, huh? Okay.
She knows everything.
Oh,
okay. I'm just a pretty face.
I'll leave that one alone.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Tom Burns, the new, for lack of a better term, Director of Pharmacy Affairs at the Oregon Health Authority. I was employee number two at that authority after Tina Edlin. It's a pleasure to come back and talk about the OPDP program. I actually was part of the original creation of that program when I wore a slightly different hat, and also to talk about Senate Bill 735, which this committee originated in. I wanted to give you a little bit of news about the program. If you look in what I handed out, you'll see a chart that looks something like this. We have just crossed the 150,000th life in our discount program. When we started back in March of 05, we've grown to over 150,000 lives in the discount program. And then we've recently started adding various groups to the program, so we now cover more than 260,000 lives in the OPDP program. The largest of that group is the OEB group, the Oregon Education Benefits Board, and the newest members, which come on in January, is OHSU. And they are all coming because we have a network where we can provide drugs to their beneficiaries at prices less than other people can. So the system is working. It's doing exactly what it was supposed to do when you created this. Let's talk about 735 a little bit. That made two major changes to the OPDP program, and both of which were very positive changes and I think are going to help the program. First of all, poor Missy was trying to negotiate contracts with a pharmacy network. And there are over 1,000 contracts that she currently has in her files of pharmacists agreeing to provide prescription drugs at a specific reimbursement rate as part of the OPDP program. It was killing her. I mean, she's one of three people that run the program, and it just wasn't working. It also presented a problem because some of our small pharmacies wanted to discuss unique rates and how they were reimbursed for the program, and she simply didn't have the capability of doing that. So Senate Bill 735 allowed the program to shift the contract negotiations with the pharmacies to the ODS. ODS is our provider of health care for this program. They run the program, they pay the claims, they handle the things, and they already have in place their own pharmacy network. We will piggyback on that, and it will allow us to have specific contracts with the pharmacists. It will get Missy out from underneath the bureaucratic paperwork, and it will allow them to negotiate specific contracts with small rural pharmacies. This issue was brought to you by some pharmacists from the eastern part of the state who said, look, we are the only pharmacist in a geographic area. If you force us to take rates that we can't sustain ourselves at, we're going to go out of business and there will be no pharmacy in this rate. So we sat down with the Office of Rural Health and said, what's a rural pharmacy? Help us understand what that is. And you will see a map attached that identifies 42 cities that they considered rural. And they said, these are cities across the state where we may have a problem. And that's all the little dots on this map, some of which have city names and some of which don't. The ones that have just the dots are rural areas that have at least two or more pharmacies in the area. So while it would be a blow to lose one, it wouldn't be a disaster to the community. We then said, what do we do with those pharmacies where there isn't a second pharmacy in the city? For example, if you look in Lane County, you'll see that Colberg and Oak Ridge both are single city pharmacies. And if those pharmacies went out of business, we would have a problem. So we looked at how do we define where we're going to go and what we're going to do. Well, in Colberg, someone could drive to some of the other cities on the I-5 corridor if they had to, whereas in Oak Ridge, in a 10-mile radius, there is no other pharmacist. And so we came up with a plan and a rule working with the rural pharmacies to define that we were going to define critical access pharmacies as any pharmacy that within a 10-mile radius, that's really just 5 miles to the nearest pharmacy because that makes a 10-mile radius, that they would be considered critical access pharmacies. And we were going to do everything we could in our power to make sure that those pharmacies stayed in our network and that they would have specific contracts that would allow them to continue to provide the services to our clients. When you look at the 10...
Mr. Chair, now explain it again so I really understand what a rural pharmacy is then.
Well, the rural pharmacies were given to us by the Office of Rural Health Care, and they went through and identified rural areas where there are pharmacies. They said it would be... we need to look at those cities where there was one and only one pharmacy.
And there wasn't another one in
within,
how many miles?
Within a 10-mile radius,
10 mile.
Which would be 5 miles of driving, because, you know, the radius is, mm-hmm. is my, mm-hmm. as my son reminds me, taking geometry, is half the size of the circle. So within 5 miles, if there wasn't another pharmacy, that pharmacy would be would be considered a critical access pharmacy. And we are going to direct, under the new authority that you've given us, the ODS company to negotiate specifically and seek out those pharmacies and make sure that they stayed in our network and that they had a specific contract that would allow them to continue to provide services to our clients at a rate that will continue to allow us to give the discounts that we give.
Just clarification.
Certainly.
Because when you say a 5-mile radius and a 10-mile radius.
No.
It's a 5-mile radius.
5-mile radius. Gotcha. 10-mile diameter.
10-mile diameter.
Right? Am I right, Missy?
Yes. Right?
Well, it's a 10-mile buffer, so it'd be...
Missy's my expert on this. So.
Yeah, my interpretation, Tom, is that it was 10 miles from the center.
So you could drive... I'm
10-mile radius.
10-mile radius. Well, then my son was wrong when we went over this the last night.
Really, but that brings a question that, like, looking at Coos County... Coquille and Myrtle Point, and actually they're 13 miles apart, so that's how they qualify. And they only have one pharmacy, but then you go to Bandon that has two, which is a hell of a long way from any place. And so I'm wondering, but because there's two...
Because there are two, we don't feel a need to make an effort to keep them in the network. We will try to keep them in the network. We want them in the network. We sit down with them and explain to them the advantages of being in the network, but they will not be considered a critical access provider.
Okay. I mean, I'm just looking at the size of the town, and supporting two pharmacies is going to be a struggle anyway in a town that size. And I guess I'm fearful of a domino effect. So they lose one, then they qualify?
Yes, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I mean, or go to Gold Beach, and there's two there, and it's a bigger town, but that's a long way from anyways.
Chair Cruz, so. this map does not show all the pharmacies. And so looking at Coquille and Myrtle Point, there's a circle over on the coast there where
right.
there are other pharmacies.
That's Bandon.
Okay, so that's Bandon. But within...
It's in my district.
Because if there was... If Bandon didn't exist there, then the two 10-mile radiuses for the pharmacies in Coquille and Myrtle Point would intersect and by definition would be included in the definition of a cap pharmacy. Because it's not only those pharmacies that are within a 10-mile radius... But as in the case of Clackskinny and Vernonia up above, their two 10-mile radiuses actually intersect. So the definition says that if one of those pharmacies closes, it definitely would have an impact on the individuals who are residing in that area. In the case of Coquille and Myrtle Point, there are two. But because Bandon enters with two more pharmacies, then you're dealing with four pharmacies. So the likelihood of one of those four closing, it wouldn't have the same impact as, say, the Clackskinny-Vernonia example, where 50% of your pharmacy network closes in that area. Am I being clear?
Yeah, I guess I'm just... it's interesting, those intersect. I know for a fact that Myrtle Point and Coquille are 13 miles apart.
Right.
Okay, so they're outside of the circle. Because the circle's 10 miles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you saying because they're 13 miles apart, their circles will intersect?
If they're 13 miles apart...
Right.
It should be on this map.
But each one, neither one by itself, their circles will intersect.
They would have if you didn't have Bandon. But it's kind of... there are pharmacies in Bandon.
Right.
So that excludes them from the definition that we have. And the definition is written in here. It says a 10-mile radius, or if the two circles intersect and there aren't other pharmacies out there, then they qualify.
Right.
The Office of Rural Health actually did this
Well, I guess I'm just looking at the topography and the fact that there are two in Bandon, which is further away, I mean, long ways from Myrtle Point, but it's about 17 miles from Coquille, I think. And it's a very windy road. It's not an easy path to follow. And so, you know, there's some logistical things, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I mean, I know where you got the map. We may need to be looking at some fine-tuning.
Right, that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering if they truly are 13 miles. It seems to me that they meet the definition. Because if you were to draw a 10-mile circle around Coquille and a 10-mile circle around Myrtle Point, there's still only one pharmacy within that circle.
Within your circle, but you go up to the, well, Claxton, Ivernoni are further apart, but their circles do intersect.
Why don't I research this with the Office of Rural Health and ask them why those don't.
Yeah.
You know, we've wrestled with the concept of rural forever. I know that, but I'm kind of, you know, especially you get down like, you know, Brookings has more than one, but Brookings also has a population that is probably is driving Mr. Taves crazy, because it's not just Oregonians that are aging down there; they're moving in from California. And so it kind of exacerbates that problem, too. And so there's just a whole lot of other pressures here. So,
well, Mr. Chair, we'll certainly examine that. But what you have pointed out here is the reason why we needed this authority is to allow us to have these kind of conversations with the individual pharmacies and to make sure that we save them in it.
And I guess my point is just to make sure that we're getting at what we hope to get at with
absolutely.
This. So,
absolutely.
Okay.
And just to, interject a little here, too. What about mail order? Is this a part of the rural or the
mail order?
The OPDP.
We do have a mail order program, and it's run by Well Partner for us. Anybody who wants to use it may use it, and it rides completely outside of the local individual pharmacies, because anybody can use it. It covers the entire state. The other advantage, which we are still working to try and put together, was the opportunity to use government purchasing organizations, or GPOs. This is a program that is available for government entities and nonprofits that allow them to come together and to buy drugs at a discounted price. When 735 was passed, it gave us the ability to look at using a GPO for some of the groups within the OPDP program. And the first group and largest group we're going to make and use is the OEB, the Educational Benefits Board, and see whether we can actually yield the kind of savings that we are being told you can yield. The way a government purchase organization will work is from the OEB members, it's absolutely transparent. You go in, you hand in your script, you get your drug, you don't see any difference. The pharmacist then submits that script for reimbursement, and somebody stops and looks at that script and says, would it be cheaper for us to go out to the government purchasing organization and use their prices or stay within the network that ODS has? And if it is cheaper, then the script will be physically, you know, electronically grabbed, and the drug from the government purchase organization will be delivered back to the pharmacy to restock the pharmacist for his product. If it's not cheaper, the pharmacist will simply get a check to cover the cost of that script. So from the client's point of view, there's nothing. From the pharmacist's point of view, it has no financial impact in that he's either going to get a check or he's going to get new product. But from the payer's, OEB's point of view, the GPO is going to be much less expensive than the current network we have in place. We're going to put that live right now with just the mail order. And that's supposed to go online January 1st. We want to see whether it works. Again, mail order, we only have one mail order. It's all in-house. They're going to look at it and ask the question. If it works at the mail order level, then we will roll it out to the retail pharmacist level. We don't know whether it works, but the opportunity will allow us to save, just in the OEP program, $2 to $3 million on a biennium. That's money that goes back to reduce the cost of providing the benefit to the OEP clients. So we think this is a great opportunity. It will allow us to continue to expand the program and allow us to continue to go out and sell the OPDP program as a network that other groups ought to use and ought to join. So with that, if I have any other questions about the OPDP program, the provisions of 735, we'll be happy to answer them. Missy is my expert on all this stuff.
No, any other questions? I'm just trying to get my hands around this because I mean, this was a fairly significant issue we dealt with during the session was
right.
Making sure that we don't start losing rural pharmacies.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. We need to make sure they're there.
And I know I can speak for Senator Morissette. He's very concerned about that,
absolutely.
Too. Isn't he, Don? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We're doing good time-wise. Status on Housing Plus implementation, Roberto Franco. Legitimate questions. Go ahead, Mary.
Perry?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roberto Franco. I work with the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department in the Director's Office. I also coordinate for the agency and the statewide program. What you have in front of you, report or status report on our housing initiative for homeless people. We call it Housing Plus, and as you'll see in the report, it stands for Permanent Living Utilizing Services. Just as a way of background, because the funding for this initiative goes back to the session in 2007. In 2007, Oregon Housing was given the authority to use the proceeds of lottery-backed bonds to begin creating permanent housing with services for homeless persons throughout the state. And it was the expectation of the 2007 session that we would create and help develop 150 units of permanent housing for homeless people. As we went through the program, we began discussing this with our local partners in the housing industry and the service industry for homeless people. And following the intent of the legislature, we focused the initiative on a particular populations. As you'll see in the report, we focus on three populations, or at least three characteristics of homelessness. One, those that are and have been homeless long periods of time or have repeated episodes of homelessness, living in the streets and emergency shelters or other temporary settings that normally would not be considered as housing for human beings. We also looked at those that are homeless and also suffer some kind of disability, either health, mental health issues, HIV and AIDS. And we also considered those victims of domestic violence that also face risk, safety risks, but also face homelessness. So those that are shuffled from shelter to shelter and can't go back to a home where they might have had before. Housing Plus, we made a conscious effort that it would target all homeless populations. So that includes families, families with children, adults, and homeless and runaway youth. Some of the funding at the federal level had focused mainly on adults with very chronic illness, but we wanted to make an effort to spread it to other populations. There are also families who may not have disabling conditions but have chronic homelessness. One of the reasons that we launched the program is that there is evidence that shows that when you provide permanent housing for a homeless person, they make better use of the services. Or put it differently, the services are a lot more effective if there is stability in people's lives. And I think a lot of us will know that. It doesn't do very good, for example, to have a medical treatment if somebody is sleeping under a bridge or somebody is camping where there's no adequate heating or plumbing and so on. Homelessness, and especially repeated episodes of homelessness, and if you add to it some disabling conditions, is a very expensive circumstance for a lot of our service systems, the law enforcement, corrections, healthcare, emergency systems, for shelter emergency, and there is some impact on the business community. Last year in 2008, a Portland Tribune story titled it "The 471,000 Men," kind of following a story in New York of the Million Dollar Murray. What basically is they follow homeless people for a certain period of time and see how much services and how much cost those services accrue for somebody that doesn't have any permanent housing. So what the Portland Tribune's story shows is that the Portland hospitals save dollars by helping pay housing for some of the homeless people that would come through their doors. And they saw a decrease in the use of, for example, emergency rooms. Most homeless people will not have health insurance, and they often use the emergency rooms as their permanent medical kind of treatment. And hospitals are required to provide treatment to somebody that walks in their door or in the emergency rooms. Similarly, also in Portland, because that's where some of the movement has taken a lot of progress, Central City Concern, one of the major providers in the metro area for homeless people with dual diagnosed living or dual diagnosed, they did a pilot study and showed that before coming into housing, the homeless people coming to their shop were using about in the range of that $42,000 just in services. After, a year after, they did a follow-up, and they had seen that there was a reduce in the cost of the services down to $17,000. And they estimated that on average, it costs between housing and services less than $10,000 in providing, again, housing and ending the cycle and preventing the cycle of homelessness for people. In one of your the handouts there, I think it believes the green sheet, it's just a quick summary of what the Housing Plus is based on. It's based on two key principles on housing first, meaning that very often, in our service system, we put people through various treatments and gradually, eventually move them into permanent housing for shelter, treatment, and as if there's a graduation into permanent housing. The idea was that put people first in housing and then work with them and figure out what is it that they need. It's also based on permanent supportive or permanent housing with services. So people who could live in these units, they can stay there as long as they comply with the lease agreements that they sign with the landlord. They're not required to receive services to live as a condition for tenancy. Because some of them may finish a treatment, for example, they could still stay there. And that's one of the models that has worked in various parts of the country and has definitely worked also in our state. The authority that we got was $16 million to create 150 units. Those of you that are involved or know about real estate, $16 million is not enough for 150 units. So the department made available other funding programs that come through our shop. And we use some of our funding mechanisms to make that fund available, and we issued a special request of proposal targeting rural communities. And my next point there is what is it that we got out of it. So out of the $16 million combined with other state and federal resources, as of today, we funded 21 projects in 13 communities throughout the state, and that represents about 215 units of permanent housing with support and services for homeless people. And it ranges for families, single adults, veterans, and again, that's throughout the state. There are now 72 of the units have been funded in rural communities. We made a special, a conscious effort to take the funds outside of the larger metro areas, and that's what we use the request for proposals for. The majority of the units are still under development, but right now there are 40 units that opened the doors and are in operations, and we expect that by the end of the year we'll have another 30 units in operations. Now, how this fits into the whole issue of homelessness, I'll briefly share that it does fit. If we follow the stories on homelessness, homelessness was already a serious issue for our state even before the economic downturn, and it's just going to get worse for at least the next couple of years because that the count or some of the numbers that we have are for the beginning of this year. So how Housing Plus fits into our work, meaning our agency, but also at the state level, it does fit to start first with the in the work that the Governor's Task Force is working on, the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. That council works on the principles of providing advice based on making recommendations that help support local communities create permanent housing. It works on the principles that we should prevent and reduce homelessness, find strategies and implement strategies that prevent somebody from going into homelessness in the first place. Lastly, is to keep people in the house. So once they're housed, for example, this in these 40 units, we gotta keep working so that in these 40 units, the households or the families do not again get back into homelessness. It does fit into the state's new plan, which I shared a copy with you. In the plan, there are three interrelated strategies. One is prevention and intervention. Basically, again, prevent somebody from becoming homeless and intervene early on. It focuses on permanent housing with support and services. We've tried to find a link that, and we've realized now that services alone don't do the job. And the same thing, housing alone is not going to do the job, even though homelessness or housing is really a question. Homelessness is an issue of housing. We got to provide housing to people. It also fits in a recent passed Senate Bill 200, which established the state's policy and statement on homelessness. In Senate Bill 200, it clearly says we got to look for permanent solutions. And lastly, Housing Plus in those communities that where there is are part of the units are part of the local community's 10-year plan to end homelessness. Right now, there's about 16 counties in our state working on their local plans, about 10 of them actually officially adopted and working on their implementation. So you may say, so how does 200 units meet the need? I'm the first one to say it's not going to meet it. In the last count that we have for 2009, there's more than 17,000 people counted as homeless, and a large majority of them are what would say repeated or have repeated experiences of homelessness. 43% of that count are families with children. Nearly 50% are single adults. And more than 25% of the children counted were younger than 18 years old. One of the major causes and factors in homelessness continues to be that they just couldn't afford the rent, which is tied to their, some of the wages that they cannot make. It's we talk about extreme poverty for people that can get out of that cycle. Unemployment is another factor, and in a lot of cases also drug and alcohol and mental illness, it's another factor in there. A lot of the homeless veterans deal with mental health issues. We see a lot of that in there. In this month, the Department of Education also just released their count for the last school year, and they counted more than 18,000 children or students in various school districts. Now, continuing with Housing Plus, again, we can't produce enough units to meet that kind of demand. In order to house the 17,000, we would need to produce at least 1,500 units every year, every biennium, even to meet the governor's or the state 10-year plan. But I think that there are ways that we can get closer to that. I think that we need to explore all kinds of options that we can have. And that means investment for new construction, for acquiring and fixing up existing units, for preserving some of the units that have rental subsidies for very low-income people, and find incentives and ways of enticing the private landlords to allow homeless families or homeless people to stay in their properties, to live in their house. There's a couple of opportunities that we have right now, and I would like to express our thank you to your leadership in passing House Bill 2436 last session, which established the housing bill, or also known as the recording fee, and that the revenues from the document recording fee will allow us, give us a boost in our abilities to create more housing, more affordable housing, and definitely for also homeless populations. Along with those revenues, there is some dedicated for continuing providing services for homeless persons or families, such as rental assistance or limited or short-term housing assistance. And lastly, in the spirit of better collaboration, which is what Senate Bill 200 calls for, we've been working with the Addictions and Mental Health at the Department of Human Services and agree on in concept of providing housing and permanent housing for homeless people with addictions and mental health. They are supportive of an application that we coordinate to the federal government under the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act for the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which is the one about acquiring and redevelop foreclosed or abandoned properties. So there's a couple of things that we're working on to continue moving this concept and model of providing permanent housing for homeless people. Now, I'm going to stop there. It's a report, and I share with you a map. It shows in there some of the communities throughout the state where there's some of the housing. The majority of will be in the metropolitan area, but that's because also they have a lot of resources that they can use to expand their units. But you can see that we've moved it all the way down to Medford, Grants Pass, Redmond, along the coast, and unfortunately, we couldn't make it all the way through the eastern part of the mountains. We had an application from LeGrand, but unfortunately, it didn't go through for other reasons, so we were not able to fund units out there.
Any questions? Senator Berger.
I may have missed it, but it seemed to me that you left out some populations. Did you mention alcohol and drug as an influence in causing people to be homeless? And then we have runaway teens, and then we have people on parole that have a hard time finding someone that will allow them to move in. And then we have sex offenders who have a public charge to let it be known that that's who they are. And so they have problems. I agree with you that we can't build our way out of this. So I guess I'm looking in the report for a little bit more emphasis on prevention of homelessness and a little bit more detail on the veteran issue as well. So if you'd like to respond to any of those, the populations that I mentioned, and then also the prevention aspect.
Do you mean, Senator, in the housing units that we funded? For homeless veterans, we did fund a project of 9 units, I take it back, in Eugene for homeless veterans developed on and then with services by St. Vincent de Paul. For homeless and runaway youth, we did not have an application from any communities throughout the state. It is very difficult to work. Not many housing developers have the capacity in working or undertake the challenge of in working with homeless and runaway youth. The initiative and the funding was open to all of those populations. We just did not have a group that was willing to undertake a project to target those specific populations. But the initiative itself, it is open for those populations that you did mention.
Thank you.
Senator
Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The map kind of reflects what I want to ask a question about. A lot of communities throughout the state, geographical communities, don't have their 100-year or their 10-year ending poverty and homelessness plans. Did you find that to inhibit their interaction with you in getting housing units at all, or did you find it enhanced their ability to work with you on this?
It did not prevent them from applying, and it was not a factor in approving or reviewing their funding. But it did also, those that have it, it did enhance their plan, because in most of the communities with a plan, they would target a certain number of units that they want to create. So they include this housing as part of their plan. For example, Lincoln County, they will have 18 units, for example, that is specifically is part of their, I can't remember how many units they're targeting in their 10-year plans. I'm trying to think of other communities. In Clackamas County, Milwaukee, we funded a duplex that is also part of their local 10-year plan. A project that we just funded a week ago in Redmond for six units for homeless people with chronic and severe mental illness. It's also part of their local 10-year plan, yes. In Josephine County, for example, they don't have a local 10-year plan, yet they have created and made available 7 units of permanent supportive housing for homeless people with mental illness.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Status on federal stimulus funds and health clinics. Craig and Madeline. They have not arrived yet. I was told that they had to be.
I think they were planning to be here about 3:00. I'll double check.
We will stand at ease for a few minutes.
Moving right along.
Where it is. convene, and we will now hear from Craig and Madeline.
Thank you, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We thought we were running a little early and found out you guys were very efficient today.
So we are good.
Our apologies for not getting good here right chair. When you guys needed us. So anyway, again, thank you for inviting both of us up here to testify. Two things I wanted to do for you today that I understand that is of interest to this committee, and one is to talk about some of the stimulus funding coming through, in my case, to community health centers, but then to also talk about and then what. I mean, you know, there's stimulus funding now, so what does the future hold for us as we go forward? And
Mr. Chair, may I just make one comment for context for the committee? Senator Morissette heard this panel do an interview on the radio, and he really liked the information that they brought forward, which is why they are here before the committee, because he felt that the committee could benefit by that information. Just so you understand the connection between the stimulus money and how we got here with these folks. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know, you should never go on the radio.
I know. They weren't smart enough to invite somebody else, I guess. But it was a Think Out Loud show, and so that was my understanding as well. So thank you for drawing that to the attention of the committee. So there's for the community health centers, there's three areas, and you've got a handout in front of you that's front and back. There's three areas that community health centers are often called federally qualified health centers have received stimulus funds across the state. And those three areas are, one, in the spring of this year, so it was one of the first stimulus funding packages out of the gate, there was something called the Increased Demand for Services Fund, and that was just taking a look at the economy's going south, uninsured skyrocketing, what can we do to get to money to these community health centers so they can continue to serve more uninsured. And that was the whole purpose of that piece of funding. The total amount of funding in Oregon was $5 million. We have 29 community health centers across the state that serve over 275,000 people, half of which about are uninsured, a little less than half, about a third are Medicaid, and then the rest are Medicare, private insurance, or other public insurance. And so what this did was allow our community health centers to either hold on to staff that they would have had to let go because their budgets were going south, all these uninsured coming through their door. But they held on to or expanded staff by 111 FTE. So it's not just providers like physicians, but other staff like nurses and so forth were added or maintained in these community health centers throughout our state. And the back of the napkin calculation on what does that mean in terms of visits for our number of uninsured, which are either maintaining access to the current clinic that is in their community, or we've added access for new uninsured. There's 10,000 uninsured patients that are benefiting from this. So they either would have been dropped because the community health center would have had to downsize, or the community health center added capacity so they could serve more uninsured. So that's the first opportunity. The second opportunity that came to the community health centers was something called the Capital Improvement Program. And it's just like it sounds. It's improve the capital buildings, equipment within the organization. So each community health center had the flexibility to figure out how to best spend that as long as it was shovel-ready. And you've probably heard that term before with stimulus, which meant it could be implemented right away. So some of them added exam rooms, some of them repaired their existing facilities, some of them renovated their facility to improve patient flow, and some of them purchased electronic medical records, software, and equipment. So there was a number of different projects. And this was awarded in June of 2000. They're still sorting out the money flow to it today for a few of the clinics, and it's one-time funding. The thing that I didn't talk about, didn't mention on the increased demand for services funding, that was one-time funding as well, which runs out in February of 2011. So they get to expand this capacity, but in February 2011, that's gone. And then the last opportunity, which there's still, this is a competitive one. The first two were formulaic, and it was based on their total number of users and their total number of uninsured users in particular, and how much money they got. This last one is competitive across the country, and it's called Facilities Improvement Program. And what this money is going for is building new facilities and new service areas, or completely replacing their existing building. They're projecting to fund about 100 of these projects across the country. The average award size is going to be around $5 million. So it's a certain opportunity. We know of about six communities in Oregon that applied for this funding. Across the country, there are 600 applications that went in for over $2 billion. So it's very competitive, and we haven't heard the results of that yet. But as you can imagine, this also will add to capacity for these clinics to serve more people. And then the last opportunity that's coming up is something that's in the information technology area, and that's still being shaped, exactly who can apply for it, what's it going to look like, and how much is it going to be. But these things are starting to form, and we're starting to get networks to apply for these in Oregon and across the country.
Is this, Mr. Chair, is this something that the health authority will be involved in, too, when we're working on our electronic record system and interoperability?
I think the results of this funding, yeah. I mean, it depends on, there's going to be different pockets of funding for IT or information technology. Some of them are just going to be specific to community health centers. Some of them are going to be, you know, can be for the broader Oregon system. Right now, there's a lot of conversations going on between OCHIN, which is our community health information network that serves community health centers and others in the state, how to get interoperability, personal health record, as well as a health bank, a data that's in a health bank. So there's a lot of discussions going on between folks at the state that will be part of the Oregon Health Authority if they're not already, and folks on the ground, and how do we best utilize these funds within Oregon. So those are the areas of opportunity for community health centers. The thing that's of concern, though, is that although the community health centers and my organization, the Oregon Primary Care Association, is very interested in this, grateful for this, but interested in the next steps, is that we're expanding access for the uninsured on one-time funding. And so what we're hoping is something changes by February of 2011 so that this access can be maintained in the communities that need these services the most. And so that's the big concern, and that's probably what the senator heard me talk about when I was on Think Out Loud. And so something has to change. So whether the number and percent of uninsured in Oregon goes down, or there's expansion of coverage through the public market or the private market, whatever happens, the number of uninsured and the percent of uninsured in Oregon needs to go down, or these access expansions that are happening over these next 2 years, it's going to be hard to hold on to those. So that's one thing. But the other thing, which I also wanted to talk about, is not just about expanding access through insurance or expanding access to the current system of care that we have. And that's my concern, is as the national or the federal debates go on, is there a line in there for actually changing the healthcare system? Because right now, folks, and you've heard me come up here and present in a number of different committees, that primary care isn't working now. People aren't going into primary care as they should, and there's a lot of shortages that are projected. So there needs to be some support and advancement of some other model of care. And one of those models that's being demonstrated and supported here in Oregon and through the Oregon Health Authority as well is called the primary care medical home model, I think was what they called it in House Bill 2009. And I would suggest that there needs to be focus in this area and payment reform to support a different model of care, because we can keep providing the same care, but sooner or later the primary care infrastructure is just going to collapse on itself. Some people said it's already at that point, but we need to change something. So the elements that's on the back of your sheet there that I handed out of what is this patient-centered, the primary care medical home, is that it's not paying primary care for a visit-based brief visit, a 10 to 15-minute visit in the office, a face-to-face visit with a provider that could be a physician, and then out. But it's shifting the payment to hold primary care accountable for taking care of a population. And so some of the elements of that model that you've seen listed there is that patients are linked to a personal provider that know them and that's working with a team of professionals. That can include a registered nurse, a behaviorist, et cetera. That the team takes the time to plan for the care of the patients that are assigned to them. Right now, they care for acute patients that come through the door, but as models evolve and get more productive, they need to be paid for differently if they're going to take care of that population of patient over time. There needs to be culturally competent outreach so that, you know, primary care is not just measured by the patients that come through the door, but they need to reach out for those patients that aren't coming through the door, getting the care that they should be getting, the prevention that they should be getting. It's also about empowering the patients to manage and improve their health, supporting healthy behaviors outside of the medical visit because they're very in control of how their health care will evolve going into the future. I mean, just that short visit isn't going to change their health care. It's what happens after that short visit. Are they managing their weight? Are they managing their diabetes? Are they taking pharmaceuticals in the prescribed manner? But it's not just them alone. The provider team that's in primary care has to support them through that journey. It's not just it's your fault, or this is what you have to do as a patient, but we will support you in this journey as a new model of primary care. And it's about enhanced access. So instead of calling up your primary care clinic and they say, well, we've got an appointment in 3 weeks or so, you can get an appointment that day if you want it. Or you can get an email or phone consultation instead of having to come in for a face-to-face visit. Or it's extended hours of operation. And then the last piece of it is that the patient isn't left alone to navigate the healthcare system by themselves, which is complex for anybody, but that they're helped through navigating to the different parts of the broader healthcare system, as well as social services, because sometimes, especially with the populations that we work with, the healthcare isn't going to be the major contributor to improving health outcomes. It may be a roof over the head, food to eat, those sort of things. So there needs to be connections back to the social services as part of this model. So that's the pieces that I wanted to present on. Is there something that you wanted to add to that, Madeline?
Adding to that or totally, yeah.
Or totally something new.
Why, is this on? Yeah. Madeline Mader, I'm from Multnomah County, Office of Chair Wheeler, and my role there is to coordinate the county's response to the federal stimulus. So I'm not from the health department, but I can give you what we were talking about Think Out Loud was the specific example of Multnomah County, and we've received two of the grants that Craig has mentioned, and we've applied for the third. So I can tell you what it looks like on the ground for us. And so for the increased demand for services grant, we were awarded $854,000, and with those funds, we've hired 18.6 FTE to create six teams in this medical home model. We're calling it it's part of the county's better, building better care. Sorry, all these different terms. Building better care model to have that medical home approach. And as a result, we're going to be able to serve 5,500 more patients, and of those, 60% will be uninsured. And this will be deployed in four of our clinics. So given the last point that Craig mentioned about social services, for example, one of the clinics that we're focusing on is on the west side of Portland, where there's a high population of homeless and transient people, and we're able to address chronic mental illness and substance abuse because of that team-based approach. The second grant that we've been awarded is the Capital Improvement Grant, and that we've been awarded $2.3 million for that, and we're working on altering physical structures and also implementing barcode technology for in our pharmacies for medication management. And this takes place in seven sites. It's affecting patient flow. It's going to have an impact on even our dental service. We'll be able to provide better and more dental service literally because of the physical changes. The third grant, the facilities improvement grant, we've actually submitted an application for the highly competitive one that Craig was talking about, and we've applied for $1.75 million in a partnership with Care Oregon, Outside In, which serves mostly high-risk youth, mostly street youth in the city, and a third partner that I'm blanking on, but it's meant for mental health services. In this partnership, we'd be renovating a building that's owned by Care Oregon in the Rockwood neighborhood in East County, which has very high levels of people living on a very low income. So those are we've received two, which were by formula, and we're applying for one competitive.
Mr. Chair, and where are these funds coming from?
They're all from HRSA. Yeah. These are all federal stimulus dollars, the ARA dollars.
And is the RFPs done with? I mean.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the first two, the funds are awarded were awarded directly to Multnomah County. They didn't go through the state because we have federally qualified health clinics, and those were by formula. The third grant, the facilities improvement project, that's competitive. And it's national, and that was due. We submitted that August 10th.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Telfer.
I'm working with three health collaborators throughout the state who are addressing specifically and have initiatives and programs for the medical home, the coordinated care, and are getting funding through the federal government's coming through the state. And so are you interfacing with the health collaborators that are, in fact, doing all this right now?
Which health collaborators are you talking
health
about?
Health Matters, 100% Access, and NEON.
Okay, yeah. There are NEON, we have folks working with them that are from statewide agencies that work with my agency. In terms of Health Matters and 100% Access down in Lane County, there's a community health center involved in that collaborative process itself. And it's a good question because I think there's two things that need to go on. One, primary care needs to change, and it needs to be plugged into a broader system. And I think that's where the collaborative model and the primary care home model, the primary care medical home model, need to fit together and interact and talk about that. But there is some cross fertilization between those two efforts.
So that is, in fact, going on, because that's not taxpayer dollars. Those are community-based nonprofits, right, so to speak. And soon, I think you'll hear the announcement that, the Senate Bill 862 that we passed just got funded millions. So as of November 1st, I know Health Matters is hiring 16 people. Mm-hmm. From the feds that's coming through the state. Remember the Bill 862, where the federal government had just come out with that funding program. So that will ensure that's going to be the health product, health coverage product. So I guess my point is, I'm a firm believer in these community-based health collaboratives because it's communities taking care of their healthy communities, making them healthy communities, right. No taxpayer dollars. And I'd like to see, other state agencies interface and help leverage some of those activities.
Right. No, I think it's a great point. I think it's a good connection between those models. And I think some of the connections that are naturally set up is Marion Blankenship, who I think sits on the NEON board, also helps staff the Safety Net Advisory Council, which I'm a co-chair of. So there's a lot of crosswalking between that. Laura Brennan was heavily involved in a lot of these different things. And through our journey through the primary care home efforts, I think there is a lot of discussion going back and forth. I think the issue is just kind of getting what are the definitions, where are the similarities, how do we plug it into the broader community. But going back to the community health centers, we came from the same kind of background as the collaboratives, which is it takes a community to set up a community health center. So get everybody on board. It can't exist by itself either. So I think there's a lot of natural philosophical ways of operating that those two different initiatives have as well. So.
Senator Berger, then.
Well, in your list here on the back page, you're talking about keeping the population healthy, and I'm sure you've thought of this, but there's quite a large percentage of the population that take responsibility for their health, and they do everything in the world to prevent being ill, mm-hmm. and they're really not very rewarded. Mm-hmm. And so I think without without taking away from those the populations that we need to care for, I don't think we should ever overlook those people that need to have some reward for what they're already doing. And they're not being, they're not a patient being tied to a health professional or help through the access. They've just done it because it's a lifestyle that they believe that they need to do so that they themselves, and they are not a burden on society. So your comment?
Well, I have a comment on that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Senator Morse actually had a bill, and I can't remember the exact concept, but regarding incentives for wellness.
For insurance plans to pay people that have...
Oh, yeah. That's what it was.
It was, I believe it was insurance companies.
Insurance plans to pay.
I think we focus so much on people that need to change their lifestyles and need to do things differently and so forth. And in other words, you know, you can dig your grave with your knife and fork. And so, but I do think there's quite a lot of people in this world that are really doing the right things. And I don't think that we should overlook them or that they should be responsible for everybody else. I think it's a rather old-fashioned idea to take responsibility for yourself.
I'd also point out that you say they don't get any rewards. Yes, they do. They're healthy, which is a pretty decent reward, I would think.
Well, it's a reward, but they also spend a lot of capital on helping everybody else try to get to a healthier lifestyle, and I think that there's something to be said for that.
It's a whole concept of empowering patients to manage and improve their own health. I'm not sure what you mean by empowering.
About what I mean by empowering? Mm-hmm. It's understanding the context of where that patient lives. So in order to empower, say, somebody that's homeless to manage their diabetes, you got to understand that homelessness may be the number one priority. And so you got to take a look at the whole patient and be able to address some of those needs so that they can address the needs that are health-specific. So I think that's an example of that. I think going back to your point, I think there has been some bills out there that talked about incentives or lower costs for those patients that are leading healthy lifestyles. And it's not something that I don't think folks would be opposed to that I've worked with. I think the issue is, though, that if we don't figure out a way to take care of those that are having trouble, whether it's chronic conditions or whatever else is bringing down their health, then everybody pays for that, including those, as you said, that are very healthy because premiums go up for everybody. And so I think there's another piece of this is if we can help other folks become healthier, the benefits will go to those that are remaining healthy because right now they're paying for the others.
This reminds me of the increased attention that we're seeing on the social determinants of health. I don't know if that is something that you've encountered yet, but internationally and domestically, there's research and an advancement on looking at what are the impacts on health other than our health access to health care. Everything from employment to housing to access to transportation to access to parks, things of that nature. It might interest you as well as you're looking at the influences on health.
I wanted to follow up regarding, I know that we have the health authority forming, and I know there's probably a subcommittee that addresses the primary care home model, because I know that was in 2009, and I think we passed another bill.
3418.
Yeah. So hopefully, is it too early to say that there's been any coordination with the 2009 effort? Probably is.
Well, I hear there's a group being pulled together to take a look at what are the elements of the medical home, and that's going to kind of transform into this, so then how do we pay for it? Janine Smith's office is working on, and I haven't heard yet that that group's been pulled together. But there is, there's trying to be some coordination between what's happened in House Bill 3418 and what's happened in House Bill 2009, so we can come up with something that can support the development of these medical homes across the state.
We're having in my committee tomorrow afternoon an update, so I think these are some of the questions we'll be asking.
Okay.
I've got several to ask.
Good.
Okay. And I'm saving them for tomorrow. So.
Good.
Anything else?
Or just a comment to Senator Berger. You know, with our auto insurance, if we don't have accidents, et cetera, our rates go down. And so you know, good drivers have better rates. So you'd think people that don't access their health providers and coverage should get lower rates.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the incentive for, I think.
That's the model.
But that would be the model, but that's not what's happening. Right now, those that are healthy, their rates are just as high as anybody else's, and their reserves, so to speak, their premiums are going to pay for health care of those that aren't taking care of themselves.
That's
so
true.
It's kind of an opposite approach of what probably should happen.
But there's also the fact that your car insurance doesn't pay for oil changes and tire changes and gas fill-ups and everything else.
But if you don't do that...
I understand that. But you know, you're kind of doing apples and oranges because they're two different dynamics in the way...
I guess my point was those that are good drivers are being rewarded in lower rates.
They're being rewarded in lower rates because they aren't incurring the sorts of things that the insurance has to cover. In healthcare, if your insurance has to cover an office visit, you know, and if you're being careful with your healthcare, you're going to go see your doctor on a regular basis. I do. I go twice a decade, whether I need to or not.
Well, there's a system, I think, that's being discussed in the news media and the newspaper every day and every channel that you turn on television. And I guess that the thing that bothers me the most is that somehow at the end of the day that nothing would be done as far as reform is concerned in our country. And so what the reform will look like, I don't know. But I do think that just having been around the political life long enough to know that sometimes when things get so testy that nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a real shame. And the philosophy of, I do believe that we are not here to see through each other, but to see each other through. So I don't want any misapprehensions about my philosophical position. But I do believe that we should never overlook those people that are trying to do the right thing. And the homeless person with diabetes is certainly at a disadvantage. But at some point, if that person can be motivated to understand that by getting their life on a better keel, there are some rewards there, more than just a roof over their head, I think that might be it. By the way, my community health center in Coos Bay, probably, I don't know if it's in Coos Bay or North Bend, it runs together right there on Broadway, but they certainly reach out to their political officials and elected officials, and we go on tours, and we're very aware of what they do and who they serve and so forth. So I wanted to be sure that you knew that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. This was thought-provoking.
Thank you.
To say the least. With that, I'm going to close the informational section of the meeting. We have on the agenda discussion of possible committee measures for February. The chair is not here. And I do want to talk to Senator Morissette about the issue of background checks. I think that, Don, take notes, please. I think that's something we might be able to encourage in a specific direction to try to make some sense out of the mess they appear to have there unintentionally at this point. But
background checks for whom?
for health care providers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, there should be a uniform system, and there should be portability within the state. Of somebody has already had a background check and wants another job, they shouldn't have to jump through that hoop again, sort of thing. So
they can move through the system.
Yeah.
With more flexibility.
We have to formalize it and vote. If the majority of people want that, then we can submit that concept. And we have to do it today because we won't have a meeting before.
Ooh, that is right, isn't it?
We got an email, Mr. Chair, on clarification. We just have, the committee does not have to take official action. The deadline is just to have it drafted. And then once it's, and that does not require any official action. It just creates a direction. That deadline is before our next meeting, which is November 14th, to have the requests in. The committee, when that LC comes back, you will then vote on that concept as an LC.
Oh, it was my understanding that how we handled it in my Veterans Committee this morning, that the committee must approve the draft or the concept.
Oh.
And you're saying that is not the case?
We got an email from Phil clarifying this, and that's the way I interpreted the email. None of you folks have. It went to the chairs of the Senate committee that the deadline. The deadline is November 13th to request an LC draft.
But to make that request, usually as a chair, I just send in these ideas that I wanted without really discussing it with the committee. And I thought that the idea was that the committee, before we send it, would make sure that the committee was on board.
Well,
that was.
I can call Phil and clarify.
Theoretically, I could be submitting LC drafts now for 11.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
This is just for 2010.
I understand that. My thought was, well, first off, just a straw poll here, nothing official. Does any member of the committee have a problem with looking into some uniformity in this background check?
Nope.
Okay.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's
not
what I think needs to happen.
So
no.
Well,
the committee could say go draft it.
We could go draft. I just didn't. Bill's not going to have a problem with that, is he, Don?
The LC issue. Yeah.
Why don't we put that on the record?
Then we'll blame you.
For the record, I'm Don Bischoff, legislative assistant to Senator Morissette. My read of that email today was the same as Sandy's, that the committee chair can submit things to LC on his own between now and the next time you guys meet, but then that the committee would have the final decision on which ones to advance to the February session.
Okay.
Now, what wasn't clear to me is whether there's any limit on the number of bills that the committee chair can request, and that's something we need to get clarified. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the clarification is the committee is only allowed two committee bills. So of whatever, how many LCs you might request, only two of those could actually be committee bills.
Right. But the committee chair could actually request more than two.
Correct.
And then the committee would make the final decision
on
which two.
Right.
I don't think there's a limit on that.
Okay.
See, and just to follow up on that, we have four possible committee bills in my committee. And so
I want to punt one back here.
Yeah, so we may want to share if you have more and we don't like the ones that my committee doesn't like what I want. I mean, we want to make sure that we maximize and make sure we have two from this committee.
Well, I'm sure we could have some
conversations. We could do that. Well, if it's okay with the committee, I just want to talk to Bill about this. And if he's agreeable, we can submit a draft to require the appropriate people to do the appropriate thing.
Yeah.
Well, Bill would presumably ask Sandy to do it. Would that be the way it would work?
Either way.
Yeah. Okay.
You would either choose to talk to them.
So if I would also assume that if any of the rest of you have any other ideas that you'd like to be considered as committee bills, let me or Bill know about it.
Okay.
And we can talk about it.
Okay. And Mr. Vice Chair, Sasha was going to bring a copy of, there she is, of the email, so you guys can just take a gander at it. On the same page.
And while we're doing that, was it this committee or my committee that did the psychologist bill?
The prescribing authority?
Yeah, I think it was this committee.
This committee, because I'm not on your committee.
You're right, it was this committee.
This committee.
And it would have
so I would like to throw out also that the psychologist would like to have a bill they're meeting now. In fact, their meeting is occurring right now between 1 and 4, I believe, with the psychiatrist and the psychologist, their first with a facilitator. And so they wanted to have a committee bill. And so I wanted to put that as an idea. It'll be in the works, but I don't know what committee.
I thought they weren't supposed to have any controversial bills in the February
session.
That's
true. That's true. That's very, very true.
You mean they're not going to have any bills?
As the chair, you're responsible for submitting up to two
committee
bill requests.
Well,
legislation.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
what we did last session was we sent the psychologist and psychiatrist saying you've got to go get a facilitator and come up with an agreeable plan. So hopefully it's not controversial.
Okay.
That's what I meant. Okay.
Okay, dear. Here's the read of it. We don't have to do anything today, but as a committee chair, you're responsible for submitting up to two committee bill requests to LC by November 13th. So as a committee chair can submit two bill requests, but each member can submit two bill requests. So a committee chair theoretically could submit four bill requests, choose two to be personal and two to be committee.
Right. Okay.
So is Bill full at this point?
Say that again.
Has Bill got his four picked out yet?
I know he has two, aside from whatever the committee might do.
Okay.
Of course, you could always seize control since you're in charge today.
being in charge of an informational meeting is a really powerful thing. well, we will, if it's okay with the chair, we will submit this as a committee bill.
Okay.
But we'll check with the good senator before we do that, because it is his call.
You're talking about the background checks?
Yes.
Yeah. And then, Don, did you get clarification of what Senator Montes Anderson's concept was?
It will be submitted, the scope issue for psychologists. It will be submitted as a request, but what committee it comes to is up in the air, and that's where we have to have.
Okay. What I just heard Senator Cruz read, though, was that the committee chair can only request drafting of two committee bills. So,
correct.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
And each member can do two as well.
So probably Senator Cruz and Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Morsett should talk about that by phone at some point.
We could do that. We could do that.
Okay.
My committee meeting then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. We'll do that.
And just as a refresher, the deadline for the LC request to be turned in is the 13th. Correct. LC then is bound by the deadline of December 15th of returning it to us. We have January to pre-session file that LC. So it's not like everything will have to take place at our next November meeting. We still have the January meeting. Work on those LCs to pre-session file.
And it's small enough to find number overall that it should be doable for LC. I don't know what the House is doing.
They only get one committee bill.
And one per representative.
And one member bill? But we're twice as smart. Okay, if there's nothing else, we are adjourned.